Chapter 18. Eventyr. Torments. Death's overdue. Every bump in the road was exquisitely transferred up through the suspension of the Galenus to send jolts of pain into Olivia's side. Her chest hurt abominably, and the fresh grafts in her chest pulled painfully every time she shifted position on the gurney. Still, she knew she was lucky to be alive. Or at least, lucky it hadn't been worse.
"You need more pain balms?"
asked Noama Calver, the surgeon captain, seeing her pursed lips.
"No," said Olivia. "I've slept for altogether too long." "Sure. Just let me know if you need any, though," she said,
missing Olivia's meaning.
"No need to suffer when there's a remedy right here."
"Trust me, if it gets too bad, you'll be the first to know."
"Promise? Hope to die,"
said Olivia, crossing her heart with her hand. Noama smiled with matronly concern. She squeezed Olivia's arm as though she were her own daughter, which was exactly the emotion Olivia had planted in her mind. Noama Calver had a son serving in an off-world army regiment, and her concern for his well-being ranked only slightly higher than the wounded men under her care. Olivia didn't like using people this way, especially good people who might have helped her if only she'd asked. Getting to Lupercalia was too important for her, for them, to take any chances that Calver might not have helped. Kajel had been even easier. A good man, he'd joined the Medicae out of a desire to stay away from the front lines, little realizing that medics were often in the thickest fighting without a weapon. The Grand Army of Molech was preparing to meet the War Master's army in open battle, so it had been child's play to ease his thoughts towards heading south to Lupercalia. Noama moved down the Galenus, checking on the other wounded they carried. Every one of them ought to be back with their units, but they'd kept quiet when Noama ordered her driver, an impressionable boy named Anson, who just wanted to get back to Lupercalia to see a girl called Fia, to drive away from the fighting. Too easy. Jeff lay stretched out on a gurney farther down the Galenus, snoring like an engine with a busted gear. She smiled at the softening of his features, hating herself for making him care for her so much. She'd had enough of time alone, and there were only so many years a girl could spend on her own before company, any company, was infinitely preferable. She knew she should have left him back in Lhasa the minute the starship crashed, but he wouldn't have lasted another hour without her. Honestly, back in the day, would you have looked twice at him? An easy enough question to answer, but it wasn't that simple. There'd been complications, two complications to be exact. Miska and Vivian sat playing a board game named Mabuza, with a number of ebony and ivory counters. She taught it to them a few months back, an old game, one she'd learned in the counting houses of the Hegemon, though she suspected it was older even than that compact city of scribes. The girls had been suspicious of Olivia at first, and rightly so. She was an intruder in their world, a rival for their father's affections, but she'd won them over with her games, her kindness, and her fantastical stories of old Earth's mightiest heroes and its magical ancient myths. No one told a story quite like Olivia, and the girls had been captivated from the beginning. She hadn't even needed to manipulate their psyches, and quite without realizing it, Olivia found herself cast in the role of a mother. It wasn't something she'd expected to relish, but there it was. They were good girls, cheeky, but with a charisma and wide eyes to get away with it. Olivia knew Jeff wasn't the reason she'd gone back to the Hab. It had been for Miska and Vivian. She'd never even considered being a mother, wasn't even sure it was possible for someone like her. She'd been told she had greater concerns than individual lives, but when the first impacts hit Lhasa, Olivia had understood how foolish she'd been to blindly accept that. Every part of her mission was compromised by having attachments. She'd broken every rule she'd set herself when she first came to Molech, but didn't regret the decision to become part of their family. If John could see her now, he'd laugh in her face, calling her a hypocrite and a fraud. He'd be fully justified, but she'd still kick him in the balls for it and call him a coward. Vivian looked over at her and smiled. Yes, definitely worth it. The girl got up from her box seat and came over to Olivia with a hopeful look in her eye.
"Who's winning?"
asked Olivia.
"Miska, but she's older, so it's okay."
Olivia smiled. Okay, one of Ol's words. Another thing she taught them. They said it in the Skolam, where the other children looked strangely at its unusual sound. I can teach you a few moves if you like, said Olivia. I was taught by the best. Could give you an edge.
No, it's okay,
said Vivian, with all the earnestness of a 12-year-old.
I do lots of things better than her, so it's good she has this.
Olivia hid a smile as she saw Miska make a face behind Vivian's back and make a gesture her father wouldn't approve of. Are you all right? Said Olivia, as Vivian climbed onto the gurney. It's been pretty hard since we left Lhasa, eh? Vivian nodded.
I'm fine. I didn't like it when the tanks were shooting at us, but I knew you'd get us out in one piece.
You did?
Yes.
Olivia smiled. A child's certainty. Was there anything surer?
Will you read me a story?
Asked Vivian, tapping the gun case tucked in tight next to Olivia. Even wounded, she hadn't let herself be parted from it. Of course, said Olivia, pressing her thumb to the lock plate and moving it in a way she kept hidden from the girl. She opened the case, feeling over her Ferlac Serpenta to the battered storybook she'd taken from the Odense Domkirke library. Some people might say stolen, but Olivia liked to think she'd rescued it. Stories were to be told, not for sitting in an old museum. The longer she owned the book, the more she wondered about that. A dog-eared thing, its pages were yellowed and looked to be hundreds of years old. The stories inside were much older, but Olivia had made sure the book would never fall apart, never fade, and never lose the old, fusty smell of the library. Olivia opened the book. She knew every story off by heart and didn't need to read from the page. The translation wasn't great, and what she read often didn't match the words written down. Sometimes it felt like the words changed every time she read it. Not by much, but just enough for her to notice, as though the stories liked to stretch and try new things every once in a while. But the pictures, woodcuts, she thought, were pretty, and the girls liked to ask questions about the strange-looking people in them as she read aloud. Vivian pulled in close, and Olivia hissed, as the synth-skin bandage pulled taut again.
Sorry.
It's okay, said Olivia. I've had worse. Much worse. Like when the guardian angel died and Noama thought she'd lost me when my heart stopped. She ran a finger down the list of stories.
Which one do you want to hear?
That one,
said Vivian, pointing.
Good choice, said Olivia. Especially now.
What do you mean?
Nothing, never mind. Now, do you want me to read it, or do you have any more questions?
Vivian shook her head, and Olivia began.
Once there was a very wicked demon, and he made a looking-glass which made everything good or beautiful reflected in it seem vile and horrible, while everything worthless and bad looked 10 times worse. People who saw their reflections ran screaming from their distorted faces, and the demon said this was very amusing. And when a pious thought passed through the mind of anyone looking in the mirror, it was twisted around in the glass, and the demon declared that people could now, for the first time, see what the world and mankind were really like. The demon bore the looking-glass everywhere, till at last there was not a land nor a people who had not been seen through this dark mirror.
Then what did he do?
Asked Vivian, though she'd heard this story 12 times or more.
The demon wanted to fly with it up to heaven to trick the angels into looking at his evil mirror.
What's an angel?
Olivia hesitated.
It's like a demon, only it's good instead of evil. Well, most of the time.
Vivian nodded, indicating that Olivia should continue.
But the higher the demon flew, the more slippery the glass became. Eventually he could scarcely hold it, and it slipped from his hands. The mirror fell to earth, where it was broken into millions of pieces.
Olivia lowered her voice, leaning fractionally closer to Vivian and giving her words a husky, cold edge.
But now the looking-glass caused more unhappiness than ever, for some of the fragments were no larger than a grain of sand, and they blew all around the world. When one of these tiny shards flew into a person's eye, it stuck there unknown to them. From that moment onward, they could see only the worst of what they looked upon, for even the smallest fragment retained the same power as the whole mirror. A few people even got a fragment of the looking-glass in their hearts, and this was very terrible, for their hearts became cold like a lump of ice. At the thought of this, the wicked demon laughed till his sides shook. It tickled him to see the mischief he had done.
Miska had come over by now, drawn by the rhythmic cadences of Olivia's voice and the skill of the ancient storyteller. With both girls tucked in next to her, Olivia told the rest of the story of a young boy named Kai, whose eye and heart were pierced by a sliver of the demon's looking-glass. And from that moment he became cruel and heartless, turning on his friends and doing the worst things he could think of to hurt them. Ensnared by a wicked queen of winter, Kai was doomed to an eternity imprisoned upon a throne of ice that slowly drained him of his life. But the parts they loved the most were the adventures of Kai's friend, a young girl named Gerda, who always seemed to be just about the same age as Miska and Vivian. Overcoming robbers, witches, and traps, she found her way at last to the lair of the Winter Queen.
"And Gerda freed Kai with the power of her love and innocence," said Olivia. "Her tears melted the ice in Kai's heart, and when he saw the terrible things he had done, he wept and washed the sliver of the demon's mirror from his eye."
"You forgot the bit about the word Kai had to spell," said Miska.
"Ah, yes, mustn't forget that bit," said Olivia. The Ice Queen had given her oath that if Kai could solve a fiendishly difficult puzzle to spell a special word, then she'd let him leave.
"What word was it?"
asked Vivian.
"A very important word," said Olivia with mock gravitas, "a word that still echoes around the world today, all the way from old Earth to Molech and back again."
"Yes, but what is it?"
Olivia flipped to the end of the story and was about to speak the word she'd read 100 times. In the original language, it was Evigeddon, but that wasn't what was on the page now.
"Liv?"
asked Miska when she didn't answer.
"No, that can't be right," said Olivia.
"What is it?"
said Vivian.
"What's the word?"
"Maud,"
said Olivia.
"It's murder."
The main war tent of the Sons of Horus was hot and humid, like a desert after the rains. Thick rugs of animal fur were spread across the ground, weapon racks lined the billowing fabric walls, and a smouldering fire burned low in a central hearth. Like the halls of a plains barbarian chief, or one of the Khan's infrequent audiences, it was bare of the comforts that might be expected of a Primarch. Horus stood at the occidental segment of the fire pit, reading from a book bound in human skin. Lorgar claimed that corpses from Istvan III provided its binding and pages, and for once, Horus had no reason to doubt him. Symbolism, that was the word his brother had used when he'd asked why a book already bleeding with horror needed to be bound so unwholesomely. That was something Horus understood, and he had arranged the others sharing the taut angles of his war tent accordingly. Grail Noctua stood to attention across from him in the oriental aspect of the soul and breath of life. Tall and proud, despite the injuries he had suffered on Molech, his augmetic hand was almost fully meshed with his nervous system, but a void still existed where his heart once beat. Gare Geradon stood in the septentrional aspect of Earth, his porcelain white doll's eyes reflecting none of the firelight. Birth, life, death, and rebirth were his aspect. Facing the leader of the Lupercai in the meridian position of fire was the floating figure of the Red Angel. Both stared at one another with crackling intensity, immaterial monsters bound to mortal flesh. One a willing host, the other a willing sacrifice. The book had enabled Horus to learn much of the Red Angel's origins on blood-soaked Cygnus Prime, just as it had allowed him to pass the rites of summoning to Malagurst. The words Horus spoke were not words as such, but harmonics, resonating in an alternate plane of existence, like musical notes or a key in a lock. Their use reeked of black magic, a term at which Lorgar sneered, but the term fit better than his Colchisian brother knew. With each couplet, the chains encircling the Red Angel pulled tighter. All but one. Its armor creaked and split still further, hissing white flame licked at the cracks. The chain encircling its skull melted away, dribbling from its mouth in white-hot rivulets.
"Is that wise?"
asked Noctua, as the Red Angel spat out the last of its binding.
"Probably not, Grail, but needs must."
The Red Angel turned its burning eye sockets upon Horus.
"I am a weapon, Horus Lupercal. The agonies of 1,000 damned souls distilled into a being of purest rage,"
it said.
"And you keep me bound with chains of cold iron and ancient wards. I hunger to slay, to maim, to wreak havoc on those that once called this shell brother."
Its words were like hooked barbs drawn through the ear. Anger bled from the demon, and Horus felt himself touched by its power.
"You will have your share of blood,"
said Horace. Yes, said the Red Angel, sniffing the air and licking its lipless face with a blackened tongue. The enemy host musters before you in numbers uncounted. Millions of hearts to devour, an age of suffering to be wrought upon bones of the dead. A wasteland of corpses shall be the playthings of the letters of blood. Noctua turned to Ger Garadon and said, Are all warp things so ridiculously overwrought? Garadon grinned. Those that serve the Lord of Murder do enjoy some bloody hyperbole, certainly. And who do you serve? Asked Horus. You, my lord, said Garadon. Only you. Horus doubted that, but this wasn't the time for questions of loyalty. He required information, the kind that could only be harvested from beings not of this world. The death of my father's sentinel in the mountain has revealed many things to me, but there are still things I want to know. All you need know is that there are enemies whose blood has yet to be shed, said the Red Angel. Unleash me. I will bathe in an ocean of blood as deep as the stars. No, said Horus, unsheathing the claws within his talon and turning to stab them through the chest of the Red Angel. I need to know quite a bit more than that, actually. The Red Angel screamed, a blast of superheated air that billowed the roof of the war tent. The chains creaked and spat motes of flickering warp energy. Cracks spread over the demon's face, as though the flames enveloping it now had license to consume it. I will extinguish you, said Horus, unless you tell me what I want to know. What will I find beneath Lupercalia? A gateway to the realm beyond dreams and nightmares, hissed the unravelling demon, cracks spreading down its neck and over the plates of its armour. A ruinous realm of madness and death for mortals, the uttermost domain of misrule wherein dwell the gods of the true pantheon. Horus pushed his claws deeper into the Red Angel's chest. Something a little less vague would be better, said Horus. Despite its agony, the Red Angel laughed, the sound dousing the last flames in the fire pit.
You seek clarity where none exists, War Master. The Imperial Realm offers no easy definitions, no comprehension, and no solidity for mortals. It is an ever-shifting maelstrom of power and vitality. What you seek, I cannot give you.
You're lying, said Horus. Tell me how I can follow my father. Tell me of the obsidian way that leads to the House of Eyes, the Brass Citadel, the Eternal City, and the Arbors of Entropy. The Red Angel bared its teeth at Ger Garadon in a blast of fury. The chains binding its arms creaked, the links stretched.
You betray your own kind, Tormageddon. You name what should not be named.
Garadon shrugged. Horus Lupercal is and always was my master. I serve him now. But even I don't know the things you know.
The obsidian way is forbidden to mortals,
said the Red Angel.
Forbidden doesn't mean impossible, said Horus.
Just because the faithless forethinker walk the road of bones does not mean you can follow him,
hissed the Red Angel.
You are not him. You can never be him. You are his bastard son, the aborted get of what he was and will one day be.
Horus twisted his talons deeper, feeling only a hollow space of scorched organs and ashen flesh within.
You cannot end me, mortal, cried the demon. I am a thing of chaos eternal, a reaper of blood and souls. I will endure any torments you can devise.
Perhaps you can, but I didn't devise these torments, said Horus, nodding towards the flayed skin book. Your kind did. Horus spoke words of power, and the Red Angel screamed as the spreading black veins thickened and stretched. Smoke streamed from its limbs, coming not from its fires, but the dissolution of its very essence.
I have your attention now? Asked Taurus, clenching a taloned fist within the Red Angel's body. I can tear your flames apart and consign every scrap of you to oblivion. Think on that when you next speak. The Red Angel sagged against its chains.
Speak,
it hissed.
Speak, and I will answer.
The obsidian way, said Horus. How can it be breached?
As with all things, snarled the demon. In blood.
Now we're getting somewhere, said Horus. The Red Angel fell slack in its chains, and Horus withdrew the crackling claw from the demon's body. Slithering black ichor dripped from the blades and squirmed into the earth around the fire pit like burrower worms. Did you get what you needed? Asked Geradon. Horus nodded slowly, flexing his talons. I believe I did, Ger, yes. Though I can't help thinking I should have got it from you. Geradon shifted uncomfortably, perhaps understanding that being summoned to Lupercal's war tent was not the honor he might have imagined. I don't follow, my lord. Yes, you do, said Horus. As I understand it, you are brother to the Red Angel. You are both children of Erebus, one birthed on a world of blood, the other on a world of fire. As in the mortal world, there are hierarchies among the Neverborn, said Geradon. To my lasting regret, a being wrought on a demon world by a dark prince of the warp is more exalted than one raised by a mortal. Even a mortal as powerful as Erebus? Erebus is a deluded whelp, spat Geradon. He believes himself anointed, but all he did was open a door. And that's the crux of it, isn't it? Said Horus, circling Geradon and letting his talon blade scrape across the Lupercai's armor. You can't come into our world unless we let you. All the schemes, all the temptations and promises of power, it's all to get into our world. You need us more than we need you. Geradon squared his shoulders, defiant now. Keep telling yourself that. Why didn't you tell me what it knew? I told you why. No, you spun a plausible lie, said Horus. Now tell me the real answer, or I'll get to the really interesting couplets in that book of horrors. Geradon shrugged. Very well. It was a rival. Now it's not. Horus sheathed his talons, satisfied with Geradon's answer. He turned from the demon things and approached Noctua, who'd stood as immobile as a statue throughout this process of demonic interrogation. There's a lesson for you here in the proper application of power, said Horus, but that's not why I summoned you. Why am I here, sir? Asked Noctua. I have a special task for you, Grail, said the War Master. You and Gear, actually. Noctua's face fell as he understood that his task would keep him from the coming battle. He rallied a moment later. What would you have me do, my lord? Horus put a paternal hand on Noctua's shoulder guard. There are intruders aboard my flagship, Grail. Intruders? Said Noctua. Who? A prodigal son and two faithless cowards who once fought as your brothers, said Horus. They lead a rabble of that troublesome sigilites, errants, fools into the heart of a vengeful spirit. I will find them, promised Noctua, and I'll kill them. Very good, Grail. But I don't want them all dead. You don't? Kill the others if they give you trouble, said Horus. But I want the prodigal son alive. Why? Asked Noctua, forgetting himself for a moment. Because I want him back. Iron Fist Mountain dominated the eastern skyline, and farther south a black smudge on the horizon spoke of distant fires somewhere around the Preceptor Line. A vast assembly of Imperial might, his army, filled the Agri Plains north of Lupercalia. Raven pushed Banilash forward, staggering as toxins in his blood distorted his perception of the night sensorium. It swayed and crashed with phantom images of winged serpents, hideous fanged mouths, and eyes that burned with the fury of rejection. The thought of what he had almost given into made him sick. Or was it the thought of what he'd given up? He no longer knew nor cared.
Raven walked his knight towards the thousands of armoured vehicles, scores of regiments and entire battalions of artillery below. A thousand shimmering banners guided him in, regimental pennants and company battle flags, muster signs and range markers. House banners streamed from the carapaces of assembled nobility, Tazkar, Kaushik, Indra, Kaskar, Mamaragon. Others he didn't recognise or couldn't make out. Their knights dwarfed the army's soldiers, but they were a long way from being the biggest, most destructive killers on the field. A dozen war engines of the Legio Griffonicus and Legio Crucius strode through designated corridors to take up their battle positions, mighty, awe-inspiring, but all dwarfed by the immovable man-made mountain at the centre of the line. An Imperator Titan, paragon of terror, was a towering fortress of adamantium and granite, a mobile citadel of war raised by long-cherished artifice and forged in blood and prayer. A temple to the Omnisire and a destroyer god all in one. The Imperator was the central bastion upon which each wing of the army rested. The black and white of the Legio were the heraldic colours of Princeps Aetana Colonis, whose mechanicum forebears had piloted the first engines on Rysa. The heat from its weapons hazed the air, and Raven blinked away tears of exhaustion. Connection fatigue made his bones ache, made every part of him ache. Broken glass ground in his joints, and the stabbing pain behind his eyes was like something trying to burrow out from the centre of his brain. Fluids recycled around his body many more times than was healthy had kept him alive, but were now poisoning him. A patrolling squadron of scout sentinels found Raven staggering from the tree line overlooking the army. They turned heavy flamers and multi-lasers on him, and he readied his own weapons in response before the proper protocols were issued and returned.
"Get me to the sacristans," wheezed Raven.
He lost track of time, or it slipped away from him. Either way, he remembered falling from Banalash's opened carapace, rough hands, metal hands, lifting him down and carrying him to his pavilion. Lix was waiting for him, but the hurt look in her eyes only made him smile. He liked hurting her, and couldn't think why. She asked questions he couldn't or wouldn't answer. His answers made no sense anyway. Needles stabbed his flesh, toxic blood was siphoned from him, and fresh liters washed in. Pain balms soothed his ground glass joints, smoothed his rough edges. Time, fractured, moved out of joint. He heard angry voices and chattering machines. He actually felt fluids moving through him, as though he was a great pumping station over the promethium wells at Ophir, sucking up immense breaths of fuel and spitting it out into the great silos. The image of himself as a vast pump pleased him. No, not a pump. An engine, an agent of change that drove the lifeblood of the planet around its myriad systems, infrastructure as a circulatory system. Yes, that was the metaphor he liked. Raven looked down. His arm was dark iron, a pistoning length of machinery thick with grease and hydraulic fluids. Promethium coated his arms, and he imagined sitting up as it gushed from his mouth in a flaming geyser. His other arm was a writhing pipe, plunging deep into the ground and gurgling with fluids pumped up from the depths of the planet. He was connected to Molech's core. The enormity of that thought was too much, and his stomach rebelled. That one man could be so intimately connected with the inner workings of an entire world was a concept beyond his grasp. His mind plunged into the depths of the planet, streaking faster than light, past its many layers until shattering through the core and emerging phoenix-like from the other side. Raven gasped for air, gulping in swelling lungfuls. A measure of clarity came with the oxygen. Lofty metaphors of planetary connection and bodily infrastructure diminished. With every breath, Raven's awareness of his surroundings pulled a little more into focus. His mouth tasted of metal and perfume, dry and with a mucus film clinging to the back of his throat. Raven was no stranger to mind-expanding narcotics. Shargali Shi's venoms had allowed him to travel beyond his skull often enough to recognise the effects of a powerful hallucinogen. He'd had his share of balms, too. Hunting the great beasts took a willingness to suffer pain, and Cyprian had beaten an acceptance of pain into him as a child. The balms he could understand. But hallucinogens? Why would the sacristans administer hallucinogens?
What did you give me?
He asked, knowing at least one sacristan was nearby. Some Medicaid staff, too, most likely from the sound of low voices, shuffling footsteps, and the click of machinery. No one answered.
I said, what did you give me?
Naga venom mixed with some potent ergot derivative,
said a voice that couldn't possibly be here. Raven tried to move his head to bring the speaker into his line of sight, but there was something wrong.
Can't move?
No. Why is that?
That'll be the muscle relaxants.
A hissing, clanking sound came from behind Raven, and he rolled his eyes to see an old man looking down at him. The face he didn't recognize at first, clean-shaven and greasy with healing agents. But the voice. Ah, no mistaking that voice. Or the hissing, clanking exosuit encasing his wasted limbs.
I'm still hallucinating, said Raven. You can't be here.
I assure you I am most definitely here,
said Albard Divine, his one good eye fluttering as though finding it difficult to keep focus.
It's taken 40 years, but I'm finally here to take back what's rightfully mine.
His stepbrother wore clothes several sizes too large for him. They hung from his bony frame like rags. The laurels of an imperial commander were pinned to his lapel.
You can't do this, Albard, said Raven. Not now.
If not now, then when?
Listen, you don't need to do this, said Raven, trying to keep the panic from his voice. We can work something out, yes?
Are you actually trying to bargain for your life?
Laughed Albard, a wheezing, racking cough of a sound.
After all you stole from me, all you did to me. 40 years of torture and neglect, and you think you're going to talk your way out of this?
That exosuit, said Raven, stalling for time. It's mother's, isn't it?
Sibella was your mother, not mine.
She's not going to like that you're wearing it.
Don't worry. She doesn't need it any more.
You killed her?
Said Raven, though he'd already come to that conclusion. Death was the only way Sibella Divine would be parted from her exosuit. But he needed more time, for the Dawn Guard to realize there was a snake in their midst, for Lix to return. Someone. Anyone.
I cut your mother's throat, said Albard, leaning close enough for Raven to smell his corpse breath. She bled out in my lap. It was almost beautiful, in its own way.
Raven nodded, and then stopped when he realized what he'd done. Either Albar didn't notice or didn't care that he'd moved, too lost in the reverie of his stepmother's murder. The muscle relaxants were wearing off, slowly. Raven wasn't going to be wrestling a Malagra any time soon, but surely he'd be strong enough to overcome a cripple in an exosuit.
Where's Lix? Asked Raven. Or did you kill her too?
She's alive.
Where?
She's here,
said Albard, leaning down to adjust the medical table on which Raven was lying.
Trust me, I don't want her to miss out on what's going to happen next.
Someone moved behind Raven, and the table rotated on its central axis, bringing him vertical. A restraint band around his waist kept him from falling flat on his face. A pair of Dawn Guard stood at the entrance of the pavilion, and a gaggle of sacristans worked at the machine, supposedly restoring him to health. His heart sank at the sight of the armored soldiers. Their loyalty was enshrined in law to the Scion of House Divine, and with Albard abroad from his tower, they were his to command. The men flanked Lix, her hands fettered and her eyes wide with incomprehension. A gag filled her mouth, and tears streaked her cheeks.
"What's the matter, Lix?"
said Albard, lurching with the unfamiliar gait of the exosuit.
"The future not playing out as you planned it? Reality not matching your visions?"
He ripped the gag from her mouth and threw it aside. She spat in his face. He slapped her, the metal encasing his hand, tearing the skin of her cheek. Blood mingled with her tears.
"Don't you touch her!"
shouted Raven.
Lix was my wife before she was yours, said Albard. It's been a long time, but I seem to remember her liking that sort of thing.
Look, you want to be Imperial Commander, yes? Said Raven. You're wearing the laurel on your lapel, I see that. Fine, yes, fine. You can be Commander, of course you can. You're the firstborn son of Cyprian Divine. The position's yours. I give you it. Have it.
Shut up, Raven, screamed Lix. Offer him nothing.
Raven ignored her. Be Imperial Commander, brother. Lix and I will leave. You'll never hear from us. We'll go south over the mountains to the Tazkar steppe. You'll never see us again. Albard listened to the rush of words without expression. Eventually he held up his hand.
You're offering me what's already mine, said Albard. By right of birth and, well, let's just call it right of arms.
Shut your mouth, Raven!
Howled Lix, her face beautiful in her tears and pain.
Don't give him anything. He killed our son.
Ah, yes. Didn't I mention that? Said Albard.
Every molecule of air left Raven's body. As surely as if a pneumatic press had crushed him flat, he couldn't breathe. His lungs screamed for air. First Egelic and Bannon, and now Oscar. Grief warred with anger. Anger crushed grief without mercy.
You bastard! Screamed Raven. I'll kill you! I'll hang your entrails from the divine towers! I'll mount your head on Banalash's canopy!
I don't think so,
said Albard, pressing a hand down on Raven's chest.
The drugs coursing around your body came from Osgar's supply. Such a good boy. He always came to visit his poor deranged uncle in his tower. Kept me informed of the comings and goings around Lupercalia, how Shargali Shi's devotions to the White Naga were spreading to his cousins in the Knights.
Seeing Raven's horror at the mention of the serpent cult's avatar, Albard grinned. The resemblance to a leering skull was uncanny.
He didn't say that every one of your knights is a devotee of the serpent cult, said Albard. Didn't mention that they were no longer loyal to you, but to the cult. No. Well, you always did see Osgar as the runt of the litter, didn't you? No taste for fighting, though I'm given to understand he was a hellion in the debauches.
Raven tried to struggle against his bindings, but even with the tiny control he'd regained, it wasn't enough.
Osgar even smuggled stims and the like past Sibella's sacristans from time to time. Such a shame I had to kill him. As much as he had a fondness for indulging his insane old uncle, I don't think he'd forgive me for killing both of you. And I think you'll agree that your deaths are long overdue.
You can't do this, pleaded Lix. I am the divine adoratrice. I saw the future. It can't end this way. I saw Raven turn the tide of war. I saw him.
You're wrong, Lix, said Albard. Asgard told me you never actually saw Raven in your visions. You saw Banalash.
Albard nodded to the Dawn Guard holding Lix. The soldier forced her to her knees and placed the barrel of his bolt pistol against her head.
I saw,
Lix began, but a gunshot abruptly ended her words.
No!
Bellowed Raven as Lix fell forward with a smoking crater in the back of her skull.
Throne, damn you, Albard! You didn't have to do that! No, 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 you didn't! Please! No!
Albard turned from Lix's body and drew a hunting knife from a leather sheath at his waist.
Now it's your turn, Raven, he said. This won't be quick, and I promise it will be agonizing.